I'm sorry, Mrs. Ganesh, but another extension on the loan is out of the question.
Oh, please. This is my home.
Where will I live?
I'm really sorry.
I am a proud woman, Miss Brown. But now, I beg for you.
Please, please,
I, Sylvia Ganesh, beg on my mother's grave. I beg you.
Let go! Security! Stop!
You shame me. I beg you. And you shame me.
Mrs. Ganesh.
Megalan, go!
Soon it will be you who comes begging to me.
Someone has cursed you. He's the Lamia, the most feared of all demons.
It's coming for me.
You deserve everything that is coming to you.
The soul of Kristen Brown!
You can give the curse away.
I'm giving it back to you! Choke on it, bitch!
You drink me, you black-hearted boy!
Oh, God, no!
I think Drag Me to Hell is a movie that Sam Raimi returned to kind of just because he loves horror, and it was almost his comeback and love letter to horror. And on top of that, it has that sociological message. It's all about the real estate crisis and things like that. But it has that giddy cruelty that only Sam Raimi can bring.
Hello, and welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jason Jenkins, call me Jinx, and that was Jamie Nash talking about Sam Raimi's 2009 horror comedy, Drag Me to Hell. Mr. Nash is a screenwriter known for such films as Altered, Lovely Molly, Exists, and that awesome Zombie GoPro short in VHS 2. Mr. Nash, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a great movie to be talking about.
Now, I got to ask, as with the beginning of every show and with every guest, out of any horror movie that you might have chosen, any at all, why is it that you went with Drag Me to Hell?
This was a tough decision. I love horror comedy. It's kind of what I came up on. When I was a kid, I had watched Halloween and The Exorcist and all those things probably by the time I was 9 or maybe even earlier, maybe by the time I was 8. So by that point, all that was really left for me was to get a good laugh and some scares at the same time. So I'd kind of already been in that postmodern point. So Evil Dead, Bad Taste, Dead Alive, Fright Night, American Werewolf, those were all movies that came to mind to choose from. But I thought I'd give Drag Me to Hell a little love because it's kind of been forgotten. And I actually think it's right up there with all those other ones I just mentioned. So it was between that and The Frighteners, another movie I think could use some love. But I'll save that one for a future guest for you.
I agree entirely with you about Drag Me to Hell. I think it's a movie that, like you said, it's kind of been forgotten, which is strange when you think about it. It came out in 2009. It's not even a decade old. But when it did come out, it seemed to be a little bit of a critical darling. Like, everyone kind of loved that movie when it came out. Everyone sang its praises quite a bit. It seemed, you know. It made just shy of $100 million here in the U.S. Like, it did very, very well, but not even a decade on, it seems like something that's sort of fallen through the cracks. It doesn't have the same sort of fan following that Raimi's 80s movies does. It's not Evil Dead 2. It's not Army of Darkness. It isn't, you know, it's not held in the same regard. And I wonder, do you have any ideas on why that might be?
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, it is a PG-13 horror movie, and it was probably at a time where the jury was still out on PG-13 horror. You know, now it seems kind of not a staple, but it's definitely an okay thing. You can have a PG-13 horror movie. Back then, it was, and amazingly, when I rewatched it, for it to be PG-13 with all the gore and some of the violence it has, it kind of is shocking that it got a PG-13 in some ways. I guess people just wanted to see more Evil Dead or something like that. And maybe the fact that, while I believe it's Sam hitting on all cylinders, it is kind of a bit of a greatest hits movie. I mean, he definitely, you know, he goes back to his toolbox and uses a lot of the things he used in those other movies. But I think he uses them with some new skills that he learned on the Spider-Man films and some of the other things and some new techniques. And you know, maybe it gets overshadowed a little bit, you know, for that reason, because people could always go back to Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness and see kind of the origins of all those things that he uses in this movie.
Absolutely. And it is kind of like a stylistic return to form for him. I agree. But, you know, it's funny. The movie has more depth, I think, than the sorts of movies he was retreading style-wise, I think.
Right.
You know, and don't get me wrong, I love Evil Dead. I love Evil Dead 2. I love Army of Darkness. But when you look at Drag Me to Hell and you compare it to those earlier movies, it seemed like he had more to say with this film than those earlier movies that, you know, went beyond simply having a fun gore gag or a fun horror comedy set piece. And I got to admit, though, being a fanboy of, you know, all of those Evil Dead flicks and having grown up on, you know, those movies, I was a little frustrated with Drag Me to Hell when it was announced that he was making it. You know, for years, we were told that there might be an Evil Dead 4. Between Raimi and Bruce Campbell, we got everything from, you know, you're never getting an Evil Dead 4. Well, it'll happen one day. It might happen one day. It's never happening. It might happen. It's going to happen. We're definitely doing it. We're not doing it. You know, every convention, you know, one might go to, every question and answer session that Campbell would participate in, inevitably somebody would ask and the stock answer would be like, oh, I've never heard that question before, you know? But it's like, yeah, okay, I get it. Sam Raimi has kind of graduated to the big leagues, not unlike Peter Jackson. You know, they're you know, two horror filmmakers who are now making these massive Hollywood, you know, films or whatever, and they kind of left horror behind. So, and you couldn't really fault them for that, but at the same time, it's like, okay, if that's the reason he's never going to do Evil Dead 4, fine. But then he does a little horror comedy, you know, in Drag Me to Hell that's not Evil Dead 4, you know. And so when it was announced, I remember just sort of slapping my forehead and saying, like, at this point, he is actively trolling his own fans, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah. And now we know in hindsight that, you know, he came out the big way with the TV show, even though he's not directly involved in the writing or the directing. At least we did finally get that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I ultimately the movie won me over in the first 2 minutes. You know, I mean, it feels like a much more polished version of early Raimi, like the sort of zaniness mm-hmm. and wacky humor and big horror set pieces, and plus a much larger budget, and how that comes together to, you know, go on the screen the way it does. It's just really jaw-dropping at times. I remember watching the movie for the first time in theaters. I actually got to preview the movie. I worked in a movie theater back in the day, and I, you know, it's like 1 a.m. and my jaw is on the floor because I was like, how did this make it to the screen? You know, I don't know that Raimi could have made this movie if he hadn't gotten the Spider-Man movies under his belt by that point.
Yeah. No, I agree. That was my take on it. To see a movie like that in a wide release was just, to me, you know, it was especially in 2009, you know, maybe in 1987 or something like that might have popped through the cracks in some weird level. But, you know, the $30 million Sam Raimi being able to flex his muscles, all those things he's learned through the years, it was just, I was amazed by it. Especially, you know, once we got to that car scene, the car attack, I was lost. He had me all the way. So the gumming and the
ruler in the mouth and the car crash, like that entire sequence is just so much fun. And, you know, one of many in the movie, too. And again, it makes me wonder why the movie isn't more loved than it is, because there's so much great stuff in there. And I wonder if it's not going to be, you know, you mentioned perhaps if it had been an 80s movie. You know, I wonder if, much like many 80s movies that we can kind of rediscover today when they, you know, hit like a special edition Blu-ray or somebody brings it up in a retrospective or something, I wonder if Drag Me to Hell is eventually going to find a much larger audience and much more appreciation than it has now, you know, down the road sometime.
Yeah, rewatching it recently, I was also struck by how in 2009, it predated some movies like Insidious And some of Insidious, it reminds me of it. Like the crazy titles, you know, that smash in the face and the music.
It's exactly the same.
Yeah. I didn't even realize. I was like, wow, yeah, this is kind of the same thing. Now, the tone of Insidious is a little bit more serious, but it has kind of an old-fashioned, fun cheesiness to Insidious. It's not just like a gritty thing. And I think Drag Me to Hell might have been a couple years ahead of its time in that regard as well.
I agree, absolutely. I wonder if, I mean, James Wan is brilliant. I love that man's movies, but I wonder if he wasn't influenced in some way by Drag Me to Hell, because I mean, the opening titles alone, the, like you said, the sort of smash cut to the title, the nerve jangling music that rises. I mean, it felt, looking back on it now in hindsight, it feels almost like a direct homage, you know, but it's funny. And I wonder if that doesn't speak to the movie being forgotten pretty quickly, because I think what Insidious was maybe 2011, maybe 2012, somewhere around in there.
Something like that.
I don't remember anybody drawing comparisons between it and Drag Me to Hell, even then, you know, even a couple of years after Drag Me to Hell came out. So I wonder what it is about that movie that allowed it to be forgotten so quickly. And
I'm not so sure. I really am not so sure. I have some suspicions that we can certainly get into. Maybe the ending, you know, because it has that story, it does have a story that you have to follow. And, you know, it could be the hero. She's not necessarily the most likable of heroes. I mean, I dig her, and I kind of like, you know, heroes that aren't 100, that are a little complicated. And I think you get behind her in the journey, but maybe some people just didn't get behind her. You know, maybe some people did not get behind Christine as that hero and what she did. Maybe, you know, she kind of deserved what she got. And then on the flip side, maybe some people don't think she deserved what she got in the end. They're just angry at the ending or how it ended or something. It just left a bad taste in their mouth. And also because, like you mentioned, the story is more complicated than Evil Dead 2 or, you know, even Army of Darkness to an extent. So there are scenes of kind of fun melodrama between her and Justin Long and the family and things like that. And maybe that just didn't appeal to people who were just only expecting a Sam Raimi kind of romp. I don't know. I mean, it could be any of those factors. They all work for me, so it's hard for me to say one way or the other.
Same here. And I, you know, I love the protagonist. I don't necessarily, well, when I say I love the protagonist, I think she is very, very well written, and she's given a sort of depth that I wouldn't have expected out of a movie of that type. And that sounds terrible to say, but, you know,
right.
When I saw the trailer, I expected, yeah, a fun romp, and you get more than that. And I think it makes it a far better movie and something that should have lingered as a result. But, you know, talking about her, do you think, and this is a far too simple question probably, but to keep it simple, do you think Christine is a good person or a bad person? Because she makes, I mean, a pretty terrible, selfish decision early on, but we're given enough backstory and character development to sort of excuse her flaws. You know, we understand why she did what she did, but as the movie goes on, her choices become more and more terrible. She kills a cat. She considers passing along the curse to an innocent. She sort of takes a kind of glee when she finally attacks Mrs. Ganesh's corpse. So
right.
I wonder, is all of that simply born out of desperation, do you think, and what she was put through? Was she a good person and, you know, kind of anybody would do the same in her shoes? Or do you think these events revealed that Christine was probably a pretty terrible person all along? She just needed the right set of circumstances to unveil that.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. You know what comes to mind when I was watching it? I was thinking about this question, and I think it's Into the Woods has a lyric. You're not good, you're not bad, you're just nice. And that's what came to mind watching her. She's not good, she's not bad, she's nice. And I think a lot of us are like that. A lot of us are nice, but if pushed, you know, or arm twisted, we would do what she did. I mean, if I was working at that bank, I probably would do what she did. So I probably deserve that curse that she got. I would screw over, the old lady probably if that was my job, if my job entailed that. And it kind of shows how, institutions can be monsters. And especially during 2009, it's, institutions, the government, these are the things that are the monsters. And if we serve those monsters, maybe we deserve to go to hell. Maybe that's the message of the film, ultimately. And to your point, I think it's sort of a coming of age story in some ways, there is a character arc there. I don't know about coming of age, but she goes from this meek pushover personality, this person who is letting other people control her life. And then she becomes somebody that kind of takes the reins by the end. And she almost becomes Ash from The Evil Dead by the end. That's like you say, she's kind of giddy and crazy. I think she might even use the line, I'm going to get some or something.
Yeah, it's a total Ash line she has.
Yeah, there's, the Raimis can't help themselves. They have to slip that stuff in somewhere. So she does become this kind of Ash-like, goofy warrior almost by the end. And I think that's really the story. And I guess that was Ash's arc in the early movies. He's kind of this weird, wussy guy. But, deep down, I guess he always had the warrior in him, as does she. It's a little weird seeing the role reversal. I think when you put a female in that role, you probably bring some baggage to that person and, for better or worse, and mostly for worse, that she doesn't get away with the things that maybe if it was Bruce Campbell would. If you imagine that same role with Bruce Campbell in it, you probably don't judge him. You probably laugh him off. There's probably not a lot of, is he good? Is he bad? Does he deserve it? You probably just go along with it and laugh with him and kind of ride it. So it's interesting to see, Sam work with a female protagonist as opposed to a male protagonist.
Absolutely, and it sort of predates the Evil Dead remake, that would come just a few years later. It almost feels like, I don't think Christine is in any way a precursor to Jane Levy's character in the Evil Dead remake, because, that movie is so much more serious grounded
right.
In a weird way. It's weird to say that an Evil Dead movie is grounded, but it is kind of, that remake, which is not really a remake, I suppose. But yeah, by having a female protagonist in an Evil Dead movie, more authentically 80s than the actual Evil Dead movies, which, back then the subversion was that it was a male lead in a movie like that.
Yeah, and if you look at, just to show you how big of a Raimi fanboy I am, I'm all in with Raimi. The Quick and the Dead, you had Sharon Stone as his protagonist in that movie, but she played it so dead serious. She was just totally serious. She didn't have some come get some lines or anything like that. She was kind of boring. I love the movie, but her character is boring in a world of fun characters. She's kind of surrounded by the fun characters. He's done that before, but never quite. Where I really do think Christine kind of becomes an Ash-like character at some point. She's got a silliness to her. She's got kind of a goofiness to her that shows after a while.
And I wonder if, it's funny that you mentioned that we might in a way sort of hold her to a different standard from Ash, because I will say watching it again last night, when she is kind of the warrior type, when she is shoving a shovel into a corpse's mouth and then, sort of putting what she thinks is the cursed object in its mouth and then kicking it shut, the jaw shut and saying something like, choke on it, bitch, feels almost like she is borderline unsympathetic to me anyway at that point, because, she started out so sweet in a way and now, plus, to be fair, by that point, we also saw her hack a cat to death. So, there is a little bit of basis there for thinking that she might be going to the dark side by the end of the movie. But again, I wonder if that had been Bruce Campbell doing the same thing, we would probably giggle and cheer him on. So, yeah, that is curious,
yeah.
I think.
Sam, I remember there's an interview with Sam, and I can't remember. It's probably on one of the DVDs, or he probably says it a lot. And he always goes over the three rules of horror movies. And I don't know that I buy his three rules of horror movies, but at least for his movies, they seem to make sense. And it's like number one is the innocent must suffer. He always says the poor sap must be tormented. And then number two was, I think it was the guilty must be punished. And number three was you must taste blood to be a man. You know, so and if you look at Drag Me to Hell, all three of those things kind of work. And I think that's how he views Christine. While she commits this sin, she commits a sin that we'd all commit. So in some ways, she's innocent of going to hell. She doesn't deserve what she gets in the beginning. And then, so she suffers still. So we still feel like she's innocent. And then the guilty must be punished. I'm not sure that happens in Drag Me to Hell as much. I don't know if I guess if she's the guilty, she gets punished for it. But certainly the woman giving the curse doesn't really get punished, so to speak, or the demon doesn't get. So I guess she's both the innocent and the guilty in some ways in that regard. And, you know, Sam has a way of saying these things that I don't know if he's entirely serious or kind of, he almost plays a Sam character in interviews, and I can't necessarily trust him. But I think his last one is the one that I see in all his movies. And I guess it's just a trope of movies in general, but you must taste blood to be a man. I think that's what this movie really is all about. And that's what most of his movies seem to be about, is some poor sap that finds themselves in an unfortunate situation and needs to taste blood to become their true self. You know, they have to be baptized in blood. And I think that's ultimately, you know, all of his horror movies seem to be that story.
And even arguably Spider-Man. I mean, I think that's probably very even true of Peter Parker.
Yeah, I'd say Spider-Man. I'd say probably to an extent Darkman, Quick and the Dead, all of his movies.
Maybe not for Love of the Game.
Yeah, maybe not. It's exactly what I was going to say. The Love of the Game, Simple Plan, maybe. The Gift, maybe. But yeah, Love of the Game, I think, might be the exception. So,
yeah. In fact, that movie feels like it almost betrays that by, I'm trying to recall a movie I only watched once and was not impressed with. But if I recall, the entire movie is a struggle for Kevin Costner choosing between, you know, his love of the game and his love of, well, the woman he loves, and the entire movie seems to be a struggle between those two things. And ultimately you would think that the movie would fall on the side of, you know, he's pitching, what is it, like what looks to be a perfect game. And he's given the option, I think, at a certain point to leave and to chase down, you know, the love of his life. But he would have to give up that dream, and the movie cheats in that it lets him have both. There is like no struggle. There is no dramatically satisfying ending to that movie because he gets everything that he wants. And it's just what lesson was learned there? I don't think there was any blood to be tasted at the end of that movie in a way.
Yeah, I think I watched the whole movie waiting for the Deadites to show up, and it just didn't happen. So I gave up at the, you know, I had to give up at some point.
But like Kevin Costner, but I don't think he would fare nearly as well against the Deadites as Bruce Campbell.
No, but he'd have a bat. It would predate Negan, I guess, or something like that, so he could fight him off. I think there is a baseball Deadite movie to be made that Sam's ready to make. But I really have to hit the one point I have to hit. There's two great cameos in this movie. One is the car. He puts the classic in this to great use as it's her car. But the other one is, did you notice Octavia Spencer just showing up in the background of the movie in the early scenes of the movie?
No.
She works at the bank. Yeah. If you go back and watch it, all of a sudden Octavia Spencer is just there, like looking over people's shoulder. Like, I don't know if it's the nosebleed scene or something like that, but it was an early Octavia Spencer extra role or something like that. It's the most bizarre thing.
So that makes one more movie that she, or one more horror movie that she has in her filmography between that and Halloween 2. That's kind of incredible.
I didn't know. That's hilarious. So maybe it's her thing. She needs to sneak in more movies and just appear in the background. But yeah, I noticed that when I watched it this time. There was Octavia Spencer. I had to freeze during it. I think my wife called her out. She was like, is that Octavia Spencer?
That's so amazing. No, I need to go back and watch it again now.
yeah, just for that. You have to freeze frame it. You have to be really fast.
So do you think, you mentioned the car makes a cameo, as it does with every Raimi movie, and I would almost like to believe that every Raimi movie is connected, that car is the same from film to film to film. I want to believe that there is some story that allows for that car to have actually woven in and out of film to film throughout his career.
Yeah, it's supposedly it's in The Quick and the Dead, but I've never found, I've never heard where. He said it's in The Quick and the Dead somewhere. I don't know to believe him or not. Maybe I should Google it. I never searched for it. So I think that car is, you know, it's probably the evil source of power or something. There has to be something going on. And then is it always the same car? Like the car that is in, I mean, I know it's the same model, but I wonder if it's the exact same car. Is he that crazy? Has he moved it to New Zealand now to be an Ashburst Evil Dead? Is it actually running? I'm fascinated by this car. I am absolutely. I want to own one. I think that would be the coolest thing to roll into horror conventions in.
Oh,
would
be that. Amazing. Class. I'm surprised it doesn't make more appearances. I mean, if that is the same car from film to film to film, it should be hitting the convention circuit. Like, fans should be getting a glimpse of this thing because, my God, you know. Yeah, I would like to think it's the exact same car. But who knows? I need to look that up, actually.
So, yeah, but Drag Me to Hell, it, speaking of the car, so it has all of the Sam Raimi classics. You know, there's flying eyeball shots. There's the crazy POV. There's almost the evil force POV shot at times. There's the giddy laughter, the puppet, the wacky Pinocchio-style puppeteer. I mean, he throws in, like, every one of his signature horror movie kind of things. But then again, this could almost detract from people, because I think some of the things people love about Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 is he was doing things that he probably had no right to do on the budgets he was doing. He was somehow exceeding his budget and giving you shots you had never seen before, even though he only had pennies to do it. And maybe when you see somebody that has $30 million do that, those same things, maybe they just don't pop as much for you, that giddy energy he has for all that stuff. Maybe you're just not used to seeing those in such a polished manner or something like that. As for me, when I watch them, I just wish more movies would have that kind of giddy energy, you know, going for it throughout the whole movie. So for me, you know, I loved all those callbacks and all those things because I can't get enough of that stuff. And I think he used them in the right places. That's the key. It wasn't like they ever felt forced. He constructed scenes using his, you know, madman's toolbox. And I think that's what I love so much about it. While he also constructed a full kind of beginning, middle, end story that he hadn't really done, in my opinion, before, which is a lot of credit to him because Ivan and him wrote that script. So it wasn't like it almost doesn't feel like the same screenwriters as, like, you know, Evil Dead or Army of Darkness. It feels like a different screenwriter. And that's what's kind of surprising about the whole thing. That's why, you know, on second, well, this is probably like my fifth watch that I've watched it. It really held up. In fact, I even liked the movie a little better this time when I watched it than I think I probably liked it back in 2009.
I'm going to say something that's going to catch me a lot of hell almost certainly, but watching it again, I always kind of felt this way, but watching it again this time, I'm pretty certain. I think it's a better movie than any of the Evil Dead films. I love the Evil Dead movies, and I'm not knocking them for that. Those movies are always going to be classics, and I'll always have a special spot in my heart for them because I grew up on them. But watching Drag Me to Hell, on every level, it's a better movie, I think, than any of those three films. I mean, it has a stronger character. It has a better arc. It has a better story with more to say than those movies. Not that those movies needed that, but, you know, on a story level, it is a better film. And not only that, but, you know, when you look at what the Evil Dead movies have to offer, you know, they're fun. They're a blast to watch, and they have these amazing set pieces. But Drag Me to Hell takes everything that he did in those movies, and it perfects it. I think look at the parking garage set piece. That is Evil Dead 2 perfected. You know, that is taking that balance of horror and humor and just polishing it to a degree that we had never seen before, I think. And plus, you know, the sound design. When you think about the Evil Dead movies, the sound design was always a huge aspect of those films. Drag Me to Hell has an even better, you know, sort of nerve-jangling sound design to it. And, you know, he strikes a great balance with all of those wacky shots, but he never sort of fully lets the movie descend into, you know, complete comedy or even camp. And that must have been such a tightrope to walk, I think. And he certainly attempted stuff like that, I think, in his earlier movies. You look at Evil Dead 2, the sequence where, Ash's girlfriend is sort of dancing, you know, her corpse is dancing outside. Like, that is, in a way, comic, but at the same time, like, it is kind of sad in a way. Like, Campbell plays the sort of tragedy in that scene, I think, a little bit. And that's a weird mix. But when you watch Drag Me to Hell, I think it's all of that stuff sort of... Again, I don't know what else to say about it except that I think it is a perfected version of what he had done earlier. And that is, people are probably going to raise hell for me saying that, and I completely understand it because those movies are... You know, it's borderline sacrilege to say that, but I think it's true. I think it is the better movie, and I wish... You know, the fact that we only got that in 2009, you know, it's almost a tease in a way because he had left horror for so long and he graduated to doing, you know, some great character pieces like A Simple Plan and The Gift. And then he started doing like, you know, the big budget studio movies like, you know, the Spider-Man films and, you know, then eventually the Oz film, which I'm not a fan of really at all. But, you know, him doing Drag Me to Hell, it felt like he might return to the genre with more frequency. And he did it so very well, one could only wonder, oh my God, what will his next horror movie be like? You know, how great is that going to be? And then he never really came back. And it makes me sad.
Yeah. And so first of all, I think you should watch your buttons because someone is totally going to put a curse on you for saying, Drag Me Out. So hold on to your buttons, okay? And I'm not going to stand next to you if I meet you at a convention or anything, just in case the 3 days are up and something, get a fly up your nose or something. But I know exactly what you mean. Well, I agree with your point, but again, I don't dare speak those words because Evil Dead 2 is probably one of my favorite movies of all time. And yeah, I don't want a curse put on me at all. I see that, I see this movie... You know, Michael Jordan, I was a big NBA fan when I was a kid. And I love Michael Jordan because he had this thing written into his contract. It was called the love of the game clause. And this movie feels like the love of the game clause. You know, it feels like, okay, I did a bunch of their movies and I fought through that crap. And now I'm going to do something that I love. And I kind of have a point to prove with it that I haven't lost it. You know, like he was going in there, I haven't done this for a while. I may, you know, some of my fans might be disappointed even that I went off and made Spider-Man and haven't continued Evil Dead. So I have a point to prove. I have to fire on all cylinders. And that's what it feels like he's trying to do, almost in a way, and I'll take my own flack for this, that maybe George Lucas wanted to do when he did the prequel. You know, he was like, okay, well, I know how to make movies and I understand technology and I can do exactly what I want to do and I'm going to do it. I think that's almost what Raimi was bringing to Drag Me to Hell. He was like, back when I did those other movies, I didn't have the budget. I didn't have the know-how. I didn't have the friends or the resources. But now I have all those things and I can bring them to bear. And I'm going to do it. And every single scene of that movie, because that's the one thing I really appreciate about Sam, is even if it's a boring, talky scene, he's like, you know, he's like the best of entertainers. They're just desperate not to bore you. And you can just feel that. Like, in every scene, he is trying to not bore you. And maybe sometimes that is even a flaw, is he's so worried about that. But at the same time, he never bores you. And I think that's what this movie really is to me. It's like him coming in and saying, I'm going to hit on all cylinders. And he does. And I'd even point to the music. Like, he's got Christopher Young there, who I think is a really underrated composer.
He's brilliant.
And why that guy isn't up there with some of the other big ones. And this movie, I never realized until I listened to it this week. I was like, why do I not have this score? Why don't I own this score? It is awesome. It's it might even be one of my favorite, you know, horror movie scores in that regard. Not that it has any key theme or anything like that, but just overall, it's got a great, great score. He's got Greg Nicotero. He's got, now he has digital effects, which can be good and bad, but I think he uses them well here. I think he mixes and matches really well. And he just kicks ass in this movie. And like you said, it's been 2009. It's 8 years. Where's the next one? We need another Love of the Game Clause. We need Sam to show up again.
I agree. And the pilot for Ash vs. Evil Dead, I don't think that counts. Which I'm not knocking that.
Yeah.
I think that show is fun. I mean, it's certainly hit and miss. And his pilot was good, but I sound like a greedy fan here. But it's not enough.
Yeah. Yeah, my take on that show, I like the show. It's one of the more watchable shows. Much like I said, it never is boring. It's never boring. But to me, it gets a little redundant. It's hard to stretch that mythology out, you know, that thin. It's just people getting possessed in a book and stuff like that. And it's difficult to stretch the Deadites out to many, 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 many seasons. Even though I have a great time watching it, and I hope they make 50 seasons, it's not Evil Dead 2. It's not Army of Darkness. It's not quite the same thing as the cinematic experience. And for that, I'll get cursed at the convention along with you. So you'll have good company in hell with you.
Well, it is too, you know, watching it. And I don't, this almost sounds like an Evil Dead bash fest from my end, and it's not. Keep in mind, I love that original trilogy. I have a lot of fun with Ash vs. Evil Dead, but I will say that TV show, you're right, it doesn't quite feel like the earlier movies, not just because it's television and not just because, you know, it's many years on, but there's kind of a weird sort of crassness to it that's not there in the earlier movies, you know, especially when it comes to Ash. I mean, when we're reintroduced to him in that pilot, like, it's, you know, I didn't want Ash to wind up there, you know, being that guy. And it also feels weird to hear him swear so frequently. And that seems probably, I'm sure, like a weird criticism, but it just feels like the TV show is a tad more mean-spirited. And not in the fun way, not in the fun, mean-spirited sort of way that, you know, Ash was always tortured in the earlier movies. Like, the TV show feels, I don't know, just a little darker and not in the good way.
I think you're right. And there's so many versions of Ash, and I think the version of Ash they took was almost the final scene in Army of Darkness that they reshot. It's almost like that was what they took, you know, him being cocky, you know, hail to the king, baby, all those lines, jumping on the, which I love that scene. I mean, I'm kind of glad that was the reshoot, because otherwise we would have never gotten that scene. But, you know, him at S-Mart, the S-Mart Ash, I think they kind of took that and they ran with it. And that's a fun Ash, but it's not like you say, it's not necessarily Evil Dead 1 Ash. It's not necessarily Evil Dead 2 Ash. It's probably, it jumped off, it evolved from that Army of Darkness Ash.
I agree.
That's my take.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, the original Evil Dead, like, Ash was just kind of a regular Joe and kind of a nice guy. And, you know, the second movie is a superhero. You know, he is the Rocky III version of Ash. He's the, you know, the Rambo First Blood Part 2 version of Ash. And then, Army of Darkness, he's kind of a jackass in a way. And it feels like, yeah, the TV show's definitely the jackass version of Ash. Would that be Jack Ash? Please forgive me for that pun. But yeah.
You know what she really needs, though, is Octavia Spencer. She was in it. Just sneaking in every couple of episodes, just looking in.
Only in the background. Only, you know, just every once in a while. It's like, is that Octavia Spencer? Just enough to keep you awake and alert trying to pick her out. No, I think she's great. I'm really sort of digressing here. I apologize. But, yeah, mentioning Octavia Spencer, her scene in Halloween 2 is horrific. Like, the way she plays it is just – you have seen Rob Zombie's Halloween 2?
You know, I've seen it, but I barely remember Halloween 2. I remember the first Halloween reboot more. I don't remember – you can – I've seen it, so you can go ahead and talk about it. You won't be spoiling.
No, it's just the – her scene is truly, truly horrifying, and due in no small part to her performance, which is – you know, she plays a nurse in the hospital that Laurie is at. Yeah, and she – oh, there's that sequence where Laurie gets up and she's looking for medication because her head is pounding and the hospital is silent. And then Octavia Spencer's character sort of rounds the corner and she has this dazed look in her eye. And you notice that there's like blood on her. And she has this moment almost like she comes to and realizes finally that she's been injured. And then she starts screaming her lungs out. And it's terrifying. That sequence. And then it's probably, honestly, her death in that scene is probably the most brutal murder that any Halloween movie ever had. It's really, really rough. It's weird that her career began so, you know, so much in horror, you know, being in Drag Me to Hell in the background and then being in Halloween 2. And then she went on to do what she did. You know, I think The Help was what, only a couple of years after that. So that's kind of, that's amazing. That's a great trajectory, I think.
Yeah, no, it's always good. I love when those actors like, the Jennifer Anistons of the world have that little horror beginning. It makes them human to me. I can relate to them. So, you know, kudos to Octavia for Drag Me to Hell.
You know, I'm still holding out hope that Jennifer Aniston gets her Halloween H2O version for her character in a Leprechaun reboot. I mean, she'll come back one day. I believe she'll come back.
I hope so. I desperately hope so. I think the world needs to see that.
But, you know, looking at Drag Me to Hell, it's funny that it was a return for Raimi to the horror genre after having been gone for so long. But what's interesting, you know, especially on this rewatch, paying attention to certain things, it seems like he isn't merely content to amp up the types of scenes that he was known for, you know, just throwing a lot of money at some of those types of wacky, zany, completely bonkers set pieces. He also uses them in a way, I think, to subvert our expectations for what we imagine those types of movies are going to have in store for us. Like, you know, that nightmare sequence early on is pretty great because we know it's a dream from the very beginning. That's not really hidden from us. We know what the deal is there. We've seen horror movies before. You know, we get it. But the great thing about that scene is it just won't end. There are several little moments within that sequence that should lead to her waking up screaming, you know, but it just holds longer than it should. And, you know, when she eventually does wake up, Christine even notes, I couldn't wake up. And, you know, I think Raimi plays with those types of horror tropes throughout, you know, sort of subverting our expectations with most of its horror scenes, I think. And not only that, but again, sort of skillfully dancing back and forth between the horror and humor and action, I think. Like, he really pumps up the action in a lot of those scenes in a way that that I don't think even I expected being a fan of his, you know, going into this movie. Even down to the Ganoush scarf attacking Christine in the final act, you know, it's just so insane, but I love it so much.
Yeah, when the scarf, like, you know, get shoved down her throat, the ghost scarf and things like that. And even, you know, there are little things like I watched it. My wife and I rewatched it this time. And the things that really got to her were those relatable things like the nosebleed scene. Oh, you know, that nosebleed scene is just terrific because it's funny. It's way over the top. But at the same time, we can all relate to a nosebleed and a nosebleed in a situation like being at work where you're all dressed up and things like that. And then they take it over the top and just spray everybody with the nosebleed or the fly, you know, the fly crawling in and out of her nose. And or her coughing the fly up in that situation, and that it, when she's having dinner and she just coughs it out of her throat and everybody's just disgusted that she has a fly in her throat. It's this kind of almost relatable horrors that I think are in some ways, I don't know if I want to say are new, but he seemed to really be concentrating on those as well. You know, and he takes them way over the top in his own Sam Raimi, you know, genius sort of way. And they were the ones that really stood out to me on the second watch. Cause of course I remembered the car scene, and the car scene is a scene you can watch in isolation. Like I could watch that right now and just laugh my ass off, or I could show it to someone. And you know, when she opens her eye, when she gets stapled in the eye and then she opens it and the staple comes flying out, like you said, with the sound design, you hear the ding and stuff like that, or the ruler shoved down her throat. It's like thematic because it's all these office supplies that are being used as weapons. And I could watch that in its own thing, as I could the seance. The seance is another scene that goat is just, I mean, that is crazy. That goat is just insane. And I finally watched behind the scenes on it. And I realized that goat isn't a real goat, because I used to think that was the most amazing goat actor I have ever seen in my life. But he's like looking back and forth at people and stuff, and I was like, this goat is amazing. But then it turns out it's just a Greg Nicotero magic trick. I hate to spoil that, but the goat is not real, which I always thought it was.
We're not even talking the possessed goat, but the actual goat that they bring out?
Yeah, that actual goat that's looking back and forth, that is actually just a Greg Nicotero puppet. Amazed me. Yeah, yeah.
That's incredible.
The level of artistry they bring to it, because like the car scene, they use this thing called a puzzle car. And the car is broken up into pieces. So, you can take the front off, you can take the back off, you can take, and how they shot that scene, it's just, the level of craft is something he probably couldn't have pulled off. Well, he would have had to found a crazy way to pull it off back in 1985 or something like that. He would have had to done some complete, he would have had to saw the car in half himself or something like that. But yeah, the puzzle cars, puppet goats. I mean, it's really insanity. You know, one thing we haven't touched on either is kind of in 2009, one of the things it got raves for was that it kind of was a message movie. You know, that was the time when the real estate crisis hit and all that stuff, the people were being foreclosed on their homes and all those things. And the funniest thing about that is this movie was written apparently 10 years before that. So
really?
They weren't even thinking about that stuff when they wrote it. It just was a happy coincidence, apparently. They wrote it during bubble times. And even when you think about it, like part of me was thinking that if the banks had foreclosed on more people and were strict about their policies, I don't know, if they were more monsters, it probably would have saved everybody's bank accounts. But, I think the problem was they probably would have given her another loan and doubled down on it and made things even worse back in the day before they kicked her out of her house. So they would have screwed her and the economy, along with her. So it's just funny that they wrote that, many years in advance. And then I saw, have you heard of this theory that it has something to do with anorexia or bulimia? Have you heard this theory?
No, I haven't. I mean, it kind of makes sense in a way, given what Christine's backstory is. But as far as the entire movie being about that, no, I haven't heard that.
Yeah, apparently, and I can't do it justice. And I honestly tried to watch it with that in mind the last time I watched it, and I can't say it really worked for me. But there's, if you Google it, there is some kind of theory that the whole movie is really just about anorexia, and it's something to do with her, body image issues and things like that. But I can't say it really held up until the end. Yes, she eats ice cream when she's upset. Or something like that, but that's about all I really saw in it. I didn't see too much else. But
yeah, that
Google it.
Let's check that out. Talking about the sort of loan that she ultimately doesn't give Mrs. Ganesh, there is this sort of thread throughout the movie where You know, forgetting the fact that she's sympathetic at times and unsympathetic at others, there's a sort of, not a subplot, but they keep touching on this idea that she can't admit that the decision not to help Ganesh was hers. She always blames it on her manager, and in such a way that it feels like she might even believe it too. You know, anytime that is raised with, say, Ganesh's granddaughter at first, or her boyfriend, you know, at a certain point, she always says, it was her manager, it was her manager, he was to blame, he was the one who did it. You know, she was just an employee. And it's funny that that is sort of a struggle for her throughout the movie, even as she's getting the hell beaten out of her, and even as she's going through all of these tortures. And she's not admitting that. And then finally, we have that what we believe to be a triumphant ending. And that allows her, once she actually wins, and once, you know, I mean, I don't know how remorseful we're supposed to believe she is, you know, after having, you know, again, shoveled open a corpse's mouth and condemned the woman to hell now, you know. But after we have that triumphant ending, she is finally able to tell her fiancé that, you know, it was her fault. And it almost seems like she gets rewarded for it because, you know, he just kind of looks at her and smiles and says she has such a good heart. But I think there has to be something said for the fact that once she finally admits it, once she actually says the words, then a moment later she is finally dragged to hell. And I don't know. How do you feel about that sort of thread throughout the movie? Do you think that it's meant to be that trigger that ultimately gets her dragged to hell, that she finally can admit it to herself that it was her fault, everything?
Right. It's an interesting point. I do have a feeling that might be where some people get lost a little bit on the end of the movie. Her boss, they make a point of saying, like, she goes to her boss and her boss says, they make a big point of this. He goes, it's your call, Christine, you know, right before she does it. And then she marches out and she makes the call. So, you know, because I didn't think the movie would work if it wasn't her call. You know, if she really was just doing her boss's bidding, but she has a choice. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on her. There's societal pressure. There's boyfriend pressure. There's employee pressure. But at the end of the day, she does make the choice. And she can't blame all those things because she made the call. And like you said, I think the way most movie logic would work is if you in the end saw what you did and acknowledged your mistake, then you'd be forgiven and you wouldn't get dragged to hell. You'd learn your lesson. And typically tragedies are kind of movies where you're offered the chance to learn your mistake and then you don't learn what you did. You don't learn from it. And then you face the consequences. And that's typically when you have a down ending with a tragedy. And in this movie, that doesn't really happen. She does acknowledge it, at least. And then she still gets dragged to hell and fulfills the promise of the title. It's almost like, I could almost say it's a bit of a nihilistic ending in a sense that she did learn from her lesson and she still died. That is a bit of nihilism, but you could argue that she did sin. So if she never sinned, even though the sin was minor, you know, as major to the woman, but, you know, she didn't murder anybody or do anything like that, though in a sense she did. It might have felt small to her, but her, you know, the weight of it, the consequences of it could have been huge. So do I think she deserved to be dragged to hell for that? No, I don't. I think she, you know, maybe it's the Catholic school Christian in me, but I think she probably deserved to live. But in the story world, she gets dragged anyway. So it is a bit of a cynical world in that respect. But that said, here's the flip side of it. Do I think she became the kind of person that would not do this again? I'm not sure. I think she might be more like her boss now, or that seedy guy that was pulling scams on her, you know, in the corner desk. She might have become less meek, but I'm not sure that she became more ethical by the end. She just became somebody that, you know, has the reins, that's going to admit that she's controlling the car And I think at the end, that's what she's become. But I'm not necessarily sure she's become somebody that's, you know, going to empathize with everyone. Or in fact, maybe in the end, she's as selfish as ever. Because look at all these, you know, killing a cat, sending Miss Ganoush to hell, essentially, by giving her the thing back. All these things she's done are really selfish actions at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And I wonder, too, you know, going back to whether or not, you know, at heart, Christine is a good person or a bad person, I wonder if she doesn't learn her lesson at the end, you know, even when she says and she acknowledges that it's her fault, and she does it with a sweet smile, and, you know, she gets her fiancé to tell her that she's a good person as a result. I wonder if that's not entirely sort of disingenuous. I wonder if she, because I wonder if Christine at heart, and I hate to say this because, you know, maybe she is a sweet person, you know, who knows what Raimi fully intended with the character, but I wonder if there is a reading of that character where she is actually, and don't we all know people like this, she is actually a bad person who has convinced herself that she is a good person. And there is that sort of, woe is me. Yeah, I made a mistake here, but I'm only human. You know, I have learned from my mistake. And I think you're completely right. I think by the end, she probably is no better. I think she can say, yeah, I did that. That was my bad. That was awful. But she's just probably going to do it again. And as a result, I wonder if the ending of the film isn't kind of, in a way, morally appropriate. You know, I wonder if she doesn't deserve it by the end, because even if she can say that and even if she can acknowledge it, I don't think she's really gained anything from that experience. I don't think she's learned anything. I don't think she's going to be a better person. And I think you're right. I think she is probably going to be as bad as her manager, or maybe eventually even worse. She's going to be one day that person behind a desk who tells another, you know, young, desperate person, you know what? It's your call. So in a way, yeah, like I think just by virtue of the fact that Alison Lohman is kind of adorable in the role, you know, you hate to see her, you know, get dragged to hell in such a way, especially when they play so long on Justin Long's face and how sort of devastated he is. Because for everything we know about him, he seems like a genuinely decent guy. But again, looking at the movie as a whole and what she did with even a little bit of provocation at the very beginning, and then where she eventually went by the end, it might not be the worst thing in the world that she did get dragged away.
Yeah. On one hand, I'd say it's kind of that, it is that cynical view of the, it's almost an indictment on all of us in some ways, because I think on the surface, and maybe even we think we're all super nice, but then when our back's against the wall, when it comes to survival, you know, will we turn into that monster? Will we kill a cat? You know, when I was watching that part, my wife was like, she's not going to kill a cat. If she kills a cat, I'm done with her kind of thing. I think killing the cat is kind of that unforgivable act, you know, to some people that they think they wouldn't cross that line. But in reality, if killing a cat meant your survival, I wonder how many people, even cat lovers, if it truly meant your survival, if it meant life or death or eternity in hell, I wonder how many people would kill that cat. So I think that's why this movie is so much deeper. You can have these lengthy discussions, and some people like it and don't like the movie for almost these reasons, because they don't believe in it, or they have a different judgment on her at the end of the day. Or they have the same judgment, and that's why they don't like her. But yeah, I think that's what makes this movie so much deeper. It's an indictment kind of on all of us, because I think we're all a little bit like Christine. We're nice. Most people are nice. Most people are friendly. Most people want to do the good thing. But when faced with getting fired, getting the next job, survival, are we really monsters? And I think what Sam's saying is maybe, you know, look in the mirror. You might, and Ivan as well, I should give credit to old Ivan. Look in the mirror. Maybe you are a monster. Maybe you think you're nice. You think you're good. But when it really comes time, will you deserve, you know, heaven or hell? And that's what I think the movie kind of leaves us with. And maybe people don't like that for some reason. I can understand why, I guess.
All right. I honestly can't think of a better way to end this show than that. Sir, I think that's just about our time. Thank you so much for being on, and thank you for choosing Drag Me to Hell. It's a movie that I think needs more love. It needs more light shown on it, and I appreciate your choosing it for this chat.
Yeah, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Now, can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can we keep an eye out for from you in the future?
Yeah, sure thing. JamieNash.net is my website. So you can look at what I'm up to on that site. I haven't updated it in a little while, but I usually do. I'm also on Twitter. I think I'm Jamie_Nash, and Jamie is spelled Jamie_Nash. So please follow me there. Lately, the latest thing I've been up to, there's a movie called The Night Watchman, which I stumbled on our great director's name. Mitch Altieri directed The Night Watchman. That's probably my next thing due out. It's playing the festival circuit right now, but rumor has it, distributor is being signed as we speak, and hopefully it'll be out sometime this year. So, and that's a horror comedy. So I practice what I love.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you again. And thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, please make certain to like, subscribe, share, rate and review us on iTunes. Tell your friends about us. And until next time, folks, thanks so much and have a great weekend.